It was a philosophical battle for the ages. On one side, the journalist, literary critic, and avowed atheist Christopher Hitchens. On the other, Douglas Wilson, an evangelical theologian and pastor of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho. The topic, is Christianity good for the world? The two men launched a debating tour together last fall, and the result of those confrontations is a documentary called Collision. It opens in New York and L.A. this week and will also come out on DVD. Both men are with me. Christopher Hitchens is in our studios here in Washington. Welcome.
Nice of you to have me.
And from Northwest Public Radio in Pullman, Washington, Pastor Douglas Wilson. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Christopher Hitchens, the two of you went around to debate this issue. Is Christianity good for the world? You were never really meant to answer that question. I mean, you answered it and Pastor Wilson answered it, but you were never meant to come to a conclusive answer, right?
Well, I'm not sure that Pastor Wilson would say that. I think he thinks there is a conclusive answer. My view is that there are no such things as conclusive answers.
Except that there is no conclusive answer.
Except there is no conclusive answer. That those who are sure... at a time when we know so much more, but about so much less, if you see what I mean. We know more than we used to, but we know now how much we don't know as well. That I think there's no role for faith, no useful role of any kind, and certainly not the Christian one.
Pastor Wilson, you don't think religion is absurd, obviously, but you think that atheists, like Christopher Hitchens, aren't very good at being atheists either.
Right.
Why not?
The argument that I would present there is that Christopher, for example, just said that he didn't see any role for faith. Well, I would want to say that because we're finite and we all have a limited starting point, it's not a question of whether we have faith, it's what we have faith in. And so Christopher, I think, has faith in the role of scientific inquiry, rational inquiry. He has faith in that process. And without assuming that process, he can't demonstrate the need for using that process. In short, he has faith or confidence in that is going to be better than the alternative. I have faith in God. Everybody who's finite and limited has to have an axiomatic starting point. And that presupposition, that axiomatic starting point, is your faith position. And Christopher is as much a man of faith as I am.
Christopher, a man of faith.
Well, no, this is I think a slightly last-ditch argument that's becoming fashionable now among Christians, is to say that people like Richard Dawkins and myself are fundamentalists, mm-hmm. that we're believers, if you like, almost that we're a church. Absolutely not so. I mean, we don't have an authority to whom we can refer things. You're only as good as your last contribution or your last piece of research or your piece of argument. There are many things about which we disagree. I mean, atheism is compatible with any other world viewpoint, from nihilism to fascism. It doesn't commit you to anything.
Christopher, can you appreciate in any way the power of religion, the usefulness of faith as a way to sort of find order in life, even if you choose not to take part?
Oh, certainly. I mean, one of the reasons this argument never becomes tedious to me is because I have a great respect for religion and for the role it's played in the evolution of the human species. I mean, it was our first attempt at cosmology, at philosophy. It was in many ways our first attempt at literature. I can quite see how people felt that faith was necessary at a time when they knew so little. But I think that we've now begun to, it might be condescending to say, outgrow it, but to transcend it.
Douglas Wilson, you talk about God in this film as an objective truth. Don't you mean a subjective truth?
No, I mean, if it were just a subjective truth, then I'm not able to get outside my own head. That means that a subjective grounding for religion is no more good for us than, say, to take hallucinogenic drugs. I could have a light show inside my skull, behind my eyes, and between my ears, but that subjective reality is worthless, ultimately, unless there's a correspondence between what I'm experiencing subjectively and an objective reality out there. Consequently, I don't believe that we can reduce it to just subjective experience without tumbling ourselves into a swamp of relativism.
Christopher Hitchens, do you believe in a force, something that Pastor Wilson might call God and something that you would not call God, that can explain what we're doing here and what sort of exists beyond this universe and in the cosmos?
That force would be the dialectic between reason, doubt, science, and inquiry. I thought you were going to ask about another kind of force. I mean, I think that there is in us, equally innate, a desire for the numinous and the transcendent. so you might say, the ecstatic, the things that express themselves in the form of music, love, art, architecture, and so forth. And religion can claim a great deal of credit in, so to speak, stirring and cultivating that impulse. But I think that impulse is with us whether we believe it's a supernatural one or not. I think a great cultural task is actually to come to terms with our need for the transcendent and the numinous without prostrating ourselves before gods that we've ourselves made.
But is there something, I mean, how do you explain what makes us all different? I mean, are we simply a mash of tissue and nerve endings, or is there something that animates all of us, what some people call a soul?
We are not just a mass, we are a fairly highly evolved outcome of a very, very long, very haphazard and very cruel a process, which, as you know, eliminated 99.9% of all the species ever present on Earth. I won't say created. It's a very haphazard and capricious creator at work, if there is one doing this, which I don't believe, of course. But we have a certain amount of cognition at the end of this process. We know how to laugh, we know how to think, we know how to fear, and we know we're going to die.
And it's just because we're programmed that way.
Not what we're programmed. That's as far as evolution has yet brought us. Sir Martin Rees, professor of cosmology at Cambridge University, says that by the time we're about halfway through the life of our sun, and when that sun goes out, those who watch it happen will not be humans. Whatever creatures there will be about as close to us as we are to amoebae.
Doug Wilson, I was struck by watching this documentary that it wasn't really about finding common ground. I mean, Hitchens thinks Wilson is wrong, and Wilson thinks Hitchens is wrong. Is that about right?
Yeah, I'd say that's right. We both disagree on a fundamental issue. And one of the things that's refreshing about talking to Christopher is he's not trying to split the difference all the time, where either if what Christopher is saying is correct, then I'm not just misguided, I'm wrong. And if what I'm saying is correct, then Christopher is wrong. The DVD is titled Collision is because we're not trying to split the difference. Christopher wakes up in the morning knowing what he thinks, and as do I.
So it's really not about convincing the other person.
No, it's about learning from the disagreement.
Mm-hmm. And so yes. I guess in the end, you'll simply be judged at the gates of heaven. You'll both be standing there and you'll find out who was right and who was wrong.
Yeah, if we're standing there at all.
Well, that's I'm not sure it's a zero sum as that, because the Christian account of it would leave no room for a reward for the person who honestly didn't believe. But it implies that there would be a reward for someone who pretended to believe in the hope of a reward.
Actually, I could correct half of that. The Christian faith does not hold out any hope whatever to the hypocrites or the posers, the people who just have purchased fire insurance and who want to go up to the pearly gates and then pretend that they can buffalo God. Well, God searches the hearts. So the hypocrites are not given any hope. If you read Jesus and his denunciations of the hypocrites, they were his worst enemies.
So, Pastor Wilson, is there hope for Christopher Hitchens? Is there a possibility you may meet him in heaven?
Oh, certainly. God is the God of all grace. And the Apostle Paul, who wrote the majority of the New Testament, was much more ferocious in his opposition to Christians than Christopher has ever been until God knocked him off his horse. But the point is that Christopher is not going to be accepted by God maintaining what he's currently maintaining. So there's not a mush split the difference sort of thing.
For a moment, I thought I was copying a plea there. I knew you'd have to remind me of that.
So the point is, it doesn't do any good to throw it all into this big benevolence vat and make all religions and all beliefs and so forth the same. So I'm not trying to do that at all. At the same time, Christopher and I get on very well on a personal level, but both part of it, I think, is because good fences make good neighbors, and we both understand that the other person really believes what they believe.
Hmm. At the end of this documentary, or around the end of it, Christopher Hitchens says something that was very interesting. You were asked whether, if you had the opportunity to eliminate the last religious person on Earth, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't pull the trigger.
That's quite right. Not just because it would leave me with no one to argue with, but because, as I began by saying, religion is an enormous part of the achievement of human culture. And it was our first attempt to make sense of the world. And so an engagement with it is absolutely necessary for one's own education and for the maintenance of tradition.
And if you flip it around, if I were confronted with the last unbeliever on Earth and I had the option of persuading him, converting him, bringing him, I'd baptize that guy.
Yes.
Christopher Hitchens and Pastor Douglas Wilson's new film, Collision, opens in New York and Los Angeles this week and will be available on DVD as well. Christopher Hitchens, Pastor Wilson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. The following words may make your mouth water. Buttermilk biscuits, baby back ribs, fried chicken, sweet potato spoon bread, pork chops, pecan pie. These dishes appear on the table regularly at family dinners, reunions, and holidays. But Southern-style cooking, when done well, is an art form. Barbara Smith, better known as B. Smith, helped transform down-home cooking into cuisine. Her restaurants, called B. Smith's, feature a variety of Southern dishes, and now some of her recipes can be found in her new book, B. Smith Cooks Southern Style. One of her restaurants is located in Washington, D.C.'s Union Station, not far from NPR. We were invited over, and B. Smith gave us a tour of the restaurant's historic dining room. This is beautiful.
I've never been in here. Let me give you a little history. This is the former presidential suites when the presidents traveled by rail. This is the main dining room. Back there is the president's signing room. We have an official, as you can see, our seal up here.
Oh, yeah.
And back there, it was a special place where he might do some signing before or be greeted and sign something when he came in. This was the president's private room. It was a dressing room. It had all the facilities back there. And over on the other side was the first lady's dressing room. And I now call this the first lady's room because I like the entrance out here to the colonnade.
Well, it's your property now,
right,
so you
right.
can do what you want. Well, let's go sit and talk about
okay.
the food. Tell us a little bit about your new cookbook. It's called B. Smith Cooks Southern Style.
Yes.
I know Southern food is the specialty of the restaurant, but you're not from the South.
I'm not from the South, and I always tell people, though, I'm from southwestern Pennsylvania. But if you're of African-American descent, somewhere along the line in your heritage, you have family that's lived in the South. So a lot of my family lived in North Carolina. So when we were young, my dad would drive us only as far as the family in North Carolina South. But the foods that my mother cooked in western Pennsylvania were Southern foods.
Do you remember a picture in your mind of, like, your first time in a kitchen and having something to do with food that wasn't just eating it?
Yes, canning. We had a garden, and we canned tomatoes and beans and all kinds of things, and then much later, we froze them. Because early on, when I was very young, so I'm telling my age, there weren't the big freezers that we eventually had. But what I really loved at home was homemade root beer.
Really?
Yes. And we had the amber bottles, the capper. I mean, so food and beverage has always been a part of my life.
And always came, it seems, from someplace not too far from where you were living.
Exactly.
And comfort food.
Right.
Which has this connotation of having as much cheese, butter, fat, even the stuff that's good for you, the collards. I mean,
right.
Some people still make them with the ham hock.
And I have a recipe in here with a ham hock, but I tell people how to defat the ham hock.
Tell us how to defat.
And what you do is, you know, you boil the ham hocks like you normally would with whatever spices you wanted to put in them. And after you boil them and they're falling off the bone, I let them cool down to room temperature, and then I put them back in the refrigerator overnight. And what happens is the fat
right.
rises to the top.
So
then I can skim it off and then proceed with the recipe.
That's a great way to make that
healthy.
I don't
feel guilty.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
healthy.
but you admit that you'd like to cook with one special ingredient, fat.
Well, I love fat. I mean, I love, and I say it that I love it in the book because it adds such great flavor.
Right.
But in moderation to these days, because I really think that all of us should be conscious of that fat intake because it's just not, you know, it's not the healthiest thing. I even have now olive oil.
Ah.
And I am introducing olive oil to the folks in my restaurant.
Hmm.
Eventually, and particularly like in a city like D.C., it's a southern city.
Sure.
Most people are used to butter. But I'm offering the alternative, and just try it with the bread and see if you like it.
We find the people responsible for implementing those healthier changes in the kitchen. But not everything can be perfectly healthy.
Good morning. What are you making?
Good morning.
Roux?
Roux. That's butter, flour, a little stock, or did...
Just butter and
just
flour.
Just butter and flour, getting that ready.
For bourbon sauce.
For bourbon sauce. Man, roux is like the cornerstone of everything.
I'm a northerner. I come from New England. Mm-hmm. I come from the land of, clam bakes and New England boiled dinners. Do you think I could learn how to cook Southern style?
Absolutely. This is a Frogmore stew on the cover.
Okay, so there's shrimp,
corn on the cob. It's got some sausage in it. And again, you can get lighter sausage, but it's very flavorful and it's fresh. And so you could do your twist on it, and you might want to add a little lobster, you might want to add, but give it its New England flair. But that's what I like about recipe books. Mm-hmm. Mine is a map, and then you take that map and you go where you want to go with it. Books, cookbooks in particular, are very challenging, but they give back a lot. So.
They sure do. Do you read them?
I do. Love to read them.
I think they're great nighttime reading.
I do, too. I mean, magazines that are food magazines, I love to read, too.
Let me ask you about food magazines.
Oh.
Gourmet. November issue, last one.
Right.
What do you think about that? I mean, that's something that's been around since 1941.
You know, I'm saddened that that the magazine is being discontinued. But there are a lot of food magazines that give recipes in a more modern way for the way the person cooks today.
Right, right. We don't have all day to make a dish.
We don't. I mean, this is a hearty book, but yet in the promo of the book I talk about, the alternatives for many different recipes from, appetizers to desserts that are healthier. But I still have very soulful dishes and, heartwarming soups that are very important in the stews. But I have a rabbit stew.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbit is coming back again. Of course, my husband is like not wanting to eat the little critter. But I also have...
you have a roast turkey. I mean, you got Thanksgiving coming. Cornbread oyster dressing.
Yes.
How do you make that?
You make it almost like you make a regular dressing, but you're just adding oysters chopped up, and you could add some of that that nice jus, the jus. I like dressing up cornbread. And for the holidays, you should have a little something extra, like the turducken.
Oh,
did
no.
Did you see that?
Yes, with the turkey is stuffed with a duck, which has been stuffed with a chicken.
Right, with three different dressings in between. So I took liberty on mine. Mine is a roulade, and I do it in steps. So it's a real, it has its own chapter.
So it's a Herculean effort, but you've broken it down into steps.
Right, and it might be something one wants to do with a sister, a pal, where maybe they do all the dressings, and you do, you make sure you have the turkey and the duck and the chicken.
Oh,
and so, and I think that could be fun. If you have people staying over and someone who loves to cook, then you have it right in front of you, and you can tell people what to do, exactly what to do.
Yeah. Barbara Smith is the author of the new cookbook, B. Smith Cooks Southern Style. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Hungry for more? You'll find Barbara Smith's recipes for Southern Style collard greens and braise of black-eyed peas and green soup on our website, npr.org. Yum. If you're a fan of 1940s stage and screen, 1960s art, or Elton John-esque songs of the 70s, then you may already be a fan of Lebanese-American singer-songwriter Mika. If not, let me introduce him. Mika gained worldwide attention from music critics in 2007 when he released his debut single, Grace Kelly. His debut album, Life in Cartoon Motion, sold over 5 million copies. He's hoping to emulate that success with his sophomore album, The Boy Who Knew Too Much. I'm talking about blue eyes, what's the matter, matter, Mika's early life was far from a happy-go-lucky pop song. In 1984, when he was 1 year of age, his family was evacuated from Lebanon to escape the civil war. During his school years, he coped with severe dyslexia and bullying by a teacher and his classmates. Mika is now considered a rising star, and he joins us from our New York bureau. What a pleasure to have you on the program.
It's very kind.
What does the name Mika mean?
Well, it means, in Catalan. In Barcelona, it means a little bit, una mica. Mica is also from mica, which is a type of mineral. But more entertainingly, mica in Morocco means plastic bag, which is kind of ridiculous because I come from a family of five children. I'm the middle child. And all my siblings have all these beautiful names. Paloma, which means dove. And then you've got Yasmin, which is jasmine, the flower. And you've got Fortuné, which means, you know, good luck or fortune, you know. Mm-hmm. And then my little sister, Allegra, which means joy or happiness. And then you've got Mika, the plastic bag. So maybe I developed some sort of complex that I tried to undo as the middle child, also known as the plastic bag.
Let's talk a little bit about this new album that you have, and particularly the first track on it, We Are Golden. You know, wonderful choruses going on. Is it at all a reference to the Joni Mitchell lyric that appears in the song Woodstock, We Are Stardust, We Are Golden?
Not consciously, maybe subconsciously, because I did grow up listening to a lot of Joni Mitchell when I was younger. I mean, we were brought up on Joan Baez, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, I mean, mainly songwriters. But I think that although it's not consciously a reference, I think that it definitely shares the sentiment. You know, this kind of like, we don't value ourselves through fixed relative monetary things. You know, we have a value that goes beyond that, and that's very much what you're chasing when you are firstly attracted to music and make music. You're chasing that feeling where there is something beyond how we kind of judge ourselves in the mirror.
You collaborate on a song with Imogen Heap, very delicate, very dreamy. What was it like working with her? And for those who might not know who she is, who tell us who she is.
Imogen Heap is an English artist who was in a band called Frou Frou and then went out on her own and had a breakout kind of success through a sync on Orange County, the TV show in the United States, and that song was Hide and Seek, and it got so famous, even though she's not a mainstream artist, it got so famous it was parodied on Saturday Night Live and a bunch of other things. And she's very talented, and she's very connected to the tools that she uses. She's a very tech-savvy artist who kind of weaves together her songs. And she's very talented, and I met her, and I thought her hair was amusing. I told her that, and we ended up working together 2 days later.
By the Time is the song you collaborated on.
Yes.
Yeah. By the time I'm dreaming, and you've crept out on me sleeping, I'm busy in the blissful unaware. By the time I'm dreaming, and you've crept out on me sleeping, tell me how am I supposed. Do you think that pop music is a hard sell in America? Because there are some people who put down pop music, and there are others who are absolutely unapologetic about writing a pop song.
I'm totally unapologetic about pop music. I think, how could anybody mock a good pop song? It is timeless. It transcends barriers. It breaks down every single type of social barrier that you can possibly have. It can deal with the most difficult subjects, even if it abstractifies the subject matter. It doesn't matter. It goes back to that empowerment theory that Paul McCartney had when he was writing Blackbird. I mean, the original lyric was Black Woman Screams at Little Rock, but he changed it, and it made it more powerful without kind of losing any of its feeling of hope or freedom. Pop music is, when it's done right, is one of the most amazing things that you can possibly have in not only kind of pop culture, but just in music in general.
Is it true you surrounded yourselves, I mean, in your writing environment, that you had, you know, a lot of visual inspiration, toys and so forth?
Well, no, not just toys. No. We can't, like, I've got this Peter Pan living in the attic, like, surrounded by my, like, by my toys and...
to give that impression.
It's more like I would print out stills from Hitchcock movies and figure out why it's such good storytelling. Or I would print out bits of pages from, I'd buy multiple copies of an Angela Carter book just to chop it all up and stick it on the walls and highlight different bits. And Angela Carter, the British author who's dead now, wrote Knights of the Circus and The Magic Toy Shop and all of that. And she was a genius. Mm-hmm. It's like a collage. It climbs the walls. Sometimes it's often on the floors, but sometimes it climbs onto the ceilings. And then I fill my studio with flowers. And I fill it with, with ideas and a computer where I stalk people on the internet and write about people who I've never met, but I've been following them for 4 months on MySpace and they have no idea.
So you maybe, I don't know, that may be a hint to your next piece of work.
I don't know. I think that, there's very much the watcher in me. I've never, the watchers and the doers, and I will firmly put myself in the watching club.
Mika, his sophomore album is called The Boy Who Knew Too Much, and he joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you, and good luck to you.
It's very kind. Thank you for having me on the show.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Touching you. I want to be your brother. Raise your father to never make you wrong for cover, even if they want us to.
We're listening to A Million. It's one of REM's oldest songs. It was on the band's first EP from 1981. This version is from a performance a quarter century later. For five nights in the summer of 2007, REM played a series of intimate rehearsals at the Olympia Theatre in Dublin, Ireland. The purpose was to test out new material, but REM also dug deep into the back catalog and played some of its best and most obscure songs. The result is a new double album called Live at the Olympia, and it charts the transformation of a small college band in Athens, Georgia, into one of the biggest and most influential rock and roll acts of the last three decades. This past week, I sat down with Michael Stipe, REM's lead singer, at his New York apartment to talk about the band, the meaning behind his music, and his perspective as he approaches age 50. Michael Stipe, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you.
This is not a collection of REM's greatest hits, by any means. It feels almost like an album that you produced for maybe your oldest fans, is it?
You know, what happened was we were trying to rehearse songs that we had never recorded, and we went back to a template from the 1980s when we toured nonstop for the entire decade of writing a song, kind of trying it out live on stage before actually going into the studio and recording it. And so with our last record, we tried to do the same thing with this Five Nights at the Olympia Theater in Dublin. A lot of the songs wound up to be, I think, fan favorites or songs that we had not heard nor even thought of, in some cases, in 25 years.
So the idea was to kind of try out these tracks that you're working on for the new album to see how the audience would respond?
Not to see how they would respond, but to see how we would respond. And that's really, that's what made this truly a rehearsal. You know, we recorded everything, not with the idea of putting it out now, but when we heard how great it sounded, we decided to hell with it. It's really worth making it public, and so we did.
On this record, fans looking for the big hits won't find them. It's the End of the World as We Know It, for example, isn't on this record. But there are those secret gems and those early pieces that take fans back to, you know, the recordings you did at Mitch Easter's drive-in in Winston-Salem. The song Carnival of Sorts, a song you wrote when you were still in college.
I think I was 21, yeah. That's crazy. Isn't that great? That's completely insane. Gentlemen, don't get caught. Boxcars, out of town. Boxcars, out of town. Boxcars, out of town. That song, particularly when I sing it, I go back to the genesis or the inspiration for the lyric, and it's a scene out of the David Lynch film The Elephant Man, and it's a nighttime scene where they've picked up a carnival and they're moving it out of a town before they're all killed or something. I don't remember, but that was the inspiration for that song. So, and I love that movie. It's become even greater with each passing decade.
A few months ago, I was playing the video game Rock Band with my nephews, mm-hmm. and they let me play Michael Stipe on Orange Crush. And it was exhilarating, you know, singing at the top of my lungs. And I wonder if, in kind of a strange way, for you to go on stage and go back through the R.E.M. catalog and just live that moment, I mean, is it fun for you? Is it exhilarating for you to do that?
The interesting thing about Live at the Olympia was for those five nights, I kept waiting for my adrenaline to kick in as a performer, because it happens very automatically for me. And when that happens, I become a different animal. And it didn't happen until the fourth night, in fact. But when it did, I suddenly found myself gesturing like the lead singer of a very big band, rather than a guy who was trying out a couple of new songs in front of a small room of people.
I want to ask you about your lyrics. You didn't include them in the liner notes on your early records, so fans had to kind of piece together what they were listening to by listening closely, this kind of Kremlinology. And a lot of those early lyrics, they're really sort of beautiful fragments, but sometimes when they're put together, they didn't always seem to make sense. And I'm thinking about the song South Central Rain. East in the mountains, third party call, by exit town, the wise man built his words upon the rocks, but I'm not bound to follow suit. I think I got this right.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern the mountain, third party call, the wise man built his words upon the rocks, but I'm not bound to follow suit. And then this really haunting apology, this I'm sorry, as if you've disappointed somebody.
Yeah.
Where were you in life when you wrote that?
At the end of a relationship, and a pretty rough one, of my own making. Rough of my own making. It's when, before cell phones, when people had landlines only, and if there was a big storm somewhere, the lines would be down and you wouldn't be able to get through, and that would be that. There was no internet, there was no other way of contacting someone. At that point, you know, I was trying really hard to kind of grapple with narrative, and I think I reached a point where the nonsense lyric was not really working for me anymore.
I mean, you say nonsense lyric, but I mean, you were writing down lyrics. You were actually writing lyrics down that fans actually took the time to really try to figure out what they were.
Well, they didn't make sense. That's the problem. They might not make sense at all. I mean, what happened was, as a band, we never intended to record our music. We just wanted to perform live. We hit a wall with that when clubs refused to book us unless we had a record or a single.
There was no sort of mechanism to allow a band like you to perform because it was all, you weren't top 40, you weren't rock and roll.
Well, no, I mean, alternative didn't exist, and so we were kind of left to our own devices. But we became a recording band, at which point I realized, well, now I have to put my voice on tape, and these are not actual words. Like, what I've been singing live through a crappy PA system really works in the room in the moment, maybe doesn't work coming out of the stereo.
I want to ask you about turning 50.
I remember turning 25 and going, oh my God, a quarter of a century.
Well, in the song Little America, you say, I can see myself at 30. I can see myself at 30.
I was kind of comparing myself to a bug stuck in amber, you know, one of those kind of Jurassic.
At 30.
At the age of 30. But yeah, that's what it felt like, I mean, at that point.
And soon you'll be 50.
Yeah, I'm 49 now, and I'm happy. I'm really happy with where I am. It's a little freakish to find myself turning 50.
I want to ask you to talk a little bit about how the process of getting older affects you as a songwriter. Mm.
The biggest problem, I think, actually, is that we have this baggage called our collective history. And when I say that, I drag every record that my band has ever made and every lyric that I've ever written, the great along with the not so great, along with the actually wretched. And when I say our collective baggage, that includes the listeners and the fans, or the people who may have only heard us around the time of Losing My Religion, Everybody Hurts, the people that have been there all along, the people who gave up on us after the third album, whatever, any version of that. I have to forget all that. I have to put all that somewhere, lock it away somewhere where I can allow the process of writing lyrics, the process of creation to be fresh and new for me with each song and with each line and with each lyric. That's the difficult part of doing this as someone approaching 50.
Do you have to dig deeper into that wellspring that you've always had to dig to?
The answer is no. In fact, I think it's become easier for me to tap into because I've made enough mistakes as a lyricist, and my contribution to what REM is and what we've done and what we've always done, I've made enough mistakes to kind of, I think, see those red flags go up right away and go, oh, don't go there. You're trying to be clever. You're trying to outdo Morrissey or Kim Gordon. No, I have to be who I am within the confines, constraints, and context of REM.
I think about when you say that about the song I've Been High, and particularly about the performance of that song on this album. It's one of the most beautiful pieces you've written.
Thank you.
And it sounds like a song you couldn't have written in your 20s.
I've been high. I've climbed so high, but life sometimes it washes over.
I mean, in my 20s, I did drugs, and I haven't done drugs since then. But there's a very obvious double entendre there that's kind of stupid. And, of course, when I wrote it, I think I had moved way far beyond that double entendre and was trying to write something that was actually quite pure.
Was I wrong? I don't know, don't answer. I just needed to believe.
Do you feel like REM's best work is still ahead of you?
I have to think that, or I would have stopped doing this a long time ago. We kind of famously were a band that never had goals, and the only goal that we did have was to try to make one of the great records of all time. I don't think we've actually succeeded at that, and I'm not sure that it's actually a goal that is attainable, but it's a nice goal to have. So I would like for the studio album that follows, Accelerate and Live at the Olympia, to be the greatest REM record of all time.
Michael Stipe is the lead singer of REM. The band's new live double album is called Live at the Olympia, and you can hear it at nprmusic.org. Michael Stipe, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Just to live my life on high. And I know you want the same. I can see.
Our program was directed by Phil Harrell today. Our staff includes Petra Mayer, Alice Winkler, Kenya Young, Travis Larchuk, and Matt Sennenwald. Our technical director is Sean Phillips, assisted today by Paris Morgan, John Widoff, Kurt Stalnaker, and Cal Southworth. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our reference librarian is Key Molesky. Rick Holter is the senior editor, and the senior producer is Matt Martinez. For Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Have a great week. Sometimes it washes over me. It washes over me. I close my eyes so I can see. Make my make-believe, believe in me. Believe in me. Believe in me.
There's been another development in swine flu news, so-called swine flu parties, where people supposedly expose themselves to the virus on purpose. While this may just be a false rumor spreading on the internet, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is taking it seriously. It's issued a recommendation on its website to avoid such gatherings. We're joined now by a spokesperson from the CDC, Tom Skinner. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, is there any evidence that these parties are actually happening?
You know, we've been getting calls for some time and about these so-called swine flu parties and anecdotal reports. And as much as we've looked into them, we have no evidence that they're actually occurring. And certainly that is something that we would highly recommend not happen.
You know, it sounds a little like the chickenpox parties that were held decades ago. I imagine the idea is basically the same, and you'd say there's something wrong with it.
Yeah, there's just no sense in having unnecessarily exposed your child to a virus that has the potential to cause a lot of illness, particularly if your child has some sort of underlying health condition like asthma or diabetes or some other underlying health condition. Influenza can be very serious.
Well, is it thought then if you're exposed to it and you get it, then you get immunity to it? I mean, that was the chicken pox philosophy.
Well, there's the problem with that is there's so many different viruses out there that mimic the flu. And so while someone might be, you know, thinking that they're actually being exposed to the flu, they very well might not be. There are lots of other viruses that mimic the flu. And so it's just simply not a good idea to even contemplate if they're actually happening.
Mm. And you use the word if they're actually happening, but you still are dealing with it.
It was something that we needed to address because we were getting a lot of calls. When we start to get a lot of calls, even if these turned out to be, you know, urban legends or myths, we feel that it's a prudent thing to do to get information out about them.
Mm. When you receive calls about these so-called swine flu parties, are they mothers getting their kids together, like for a play group, a swine flu play group?
I think it's mostly parents of small children that are, you know, asking questions or sending messages and notes around. We do a really good job of monitoring some of the social media, whether it's Twitter or Facebook. And, you know, we've seen some traffic on those social networks asking about swine flu parties and questions about swine flu parties. We've never been able to really track down that these are happening, so we've just done what we can to respond through interviews like this and posting information on our website.
Are you and the rest of the CDC media team kind of running a full court press right now?
Absolutely. It's been quite a ride since this virus was first recognized in late April, and we're doing everything we humanly possibly can to educate people about how it's transmitted and what they can do to protect themselves, and continuing to strongly encourage people to get vaccinated when vaccine becomes available.
Tom Skinner is a spokesperson for the CDC. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Now a question for you. Do you know someone who has held a swine flu party? Have you held one? Join our discussion group at facebook.com/NPR Weekend. You can also post comments at npr.org/soapbox. You're listening to NPR News. When commuters ride the train in the northwest suburbs of Philadelphia, most don't know they are passing within a stone's throw of a mass grave. Historians are excavating what could be the remains of more than 50 Irish laborers buried underneath the railroad. From member station WHYY in Philadelphia, Peter Crimmins has the story.
This section of the railroad is called Duffy's Cut. It's in a small, densely wooded valley behind a housing development, and it's known for its ghost stories.
The main one actually dates from September of 1832. A local man was walking down the tracks, looked down into this valley where the Irishmen were buried, and saw their ghosts dancing on the graves.
Frank Watson is part of the archaeological team that used historical documents, geothermal sensing equipment, and spooky ghost stories to pinpoint the dig site. So far, he and his colleagues have uncovered parts of 4 skeletons, and they feel certain there are more. The researchers don't know their names, but they have an idea about where the workers came from. A ship's log shows a group of men sailed from County Donegal in Ireland to Philadelphia in the summer of 1832. 57 men were hired to work the railroad. University of Maryland professor Steve Brighton says this may be the most important archaeological site of the Irish diaspora in America.
We reconstruct ourselves and past societies through teacups and saucers and bottles. What we don't get is the individual experience between poor, laboring poor, wealthy, elites. How does that play out on the body?
Also arriving from Europe in 1832 was a cholera pandemic. Immaculata University history professor John Otis says these men stuck in this valley with no medical support were ravaged by disease and maybe something more.
Whether there was also a degree of violence in keeping the men in the valley or perhaps in murdering them is speculative, but we have found in the first 2 complete skulls that we've discovered here in the dig evidence of physical violence.
The 2 complete skulls the team dug up both have holes punched in them.
Immigrants, particularly Irish Catholic ones, weren't terribly well liked in the best of circumstances, but when they were seen as bringing a dreadful disease into the region, certainly at a time when people would turn on members of their own family, you can imagine what they might do to an immigrant work crew.
The excavation leader is Immaculata history professor Bill Watson. He suspects the men buried their own under the tracks one by one.
There's an old railroad song, "Bury Me in the Fill." Bury me where I work in the fill.
If I die a railroad man, bury me under the tie, so I can hear row number 9 as she goes rolling by.
This became the custom in later years, to bury men in the fill where they worked when they died. This is the first case that we know of men being buried in the fill.
The parts of skeletons that Watson and his crew have dug up will soon undergo DNA testing, and maybe the living descendants can be identified. Ultimately, the remains of these poor laborers lost to history will find their final resting place back home in Ireland. For NPR News, I'm Peter Crimmins in Philadelphia.